The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Administrator Murphy, at the end of the day, has a formal determination to make that unlocks access to money and logistical resources, but that really pales in comparison to how much the transition really turns upon informal relationships and informal cooperation between, you know, outgoing political agency heads and incoming landing teams for each of these departments. And, you know, the model historically, even in the Obama to Trump transition, right, has been a pretty, if not friendly, at least cordial and cooperative process where, you know, you hear scattershot reports of people behaving badly, but the norm is cooperation.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 10th, 2020. President Trump yesterday fired the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, the latest in a string of dismissals. Meanwhile, the Biden campaign is trying to put a transition together, but the head of the General Services Administration will not ascertain that the transition has begun. We got a group together to talk about the wrangling and the transition. Scott Anderson, Steve Vladek, Susan Hennessy joined me in the virtual jungle studio. We covered a lot of ground. The president's surprise removal of staff who have offended him, or maybe not so surprise. How do you run a transition? What does the law require? And why won't the GSA get this one started? And how do you staff an administration? And what are the particular challenges Biden will face? It's the Lawfare Podcast, November 10th. Firings, transitions, and staffing. Oh my. We were planning to do a podcast about the transition, but just as we were getting ready to record, the president fired the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper. And so I suppose we should start by talking about this spate of firings, which isn't what you usually see in a transition. Steve, get us started. Who has been removed over the last few days, and what do we know about the circumstances of it?
I feel like it's a line in The Godfather, right? Today we settle all family business.
Well, so, they're still alive.
Well, for the moment. So, you know, I think that the short version, Ben, is that I think, you know, the Esper firing is the culmination of a couple of others, right, that we knew. I think we all suspected the Esper firing was coming. The president had made it known that he was looking at replacing Esper, FBI Director Wray, maybe CIA Director Haspel. And Esper, of course, has been to some degree a thorn in the president's side. I guess I just, you know, the timing to me is interesting in a couple of respects, even before we get to the legal questions it raises, because, you know, I don't know that if you're in the middle of still fighting for your electoral life, this is the kind of chaos you want to sow, right? And so I guess, you know, that's why I'm not sure this is any part of like an orchestrated plan, as opposed to just the president getting revenge. I mean, so for example, Friday, the White House fired Bonnie Glick, the Senate confirmed Deputy Administrator of USAID, right? And so, you know, I feel like this is not some coordinated part of a post-election conspiracy, but rather the president basically conceding that it's over and, you know, lashing out in vengeance against those who he thinks has wronged him.
Okay, but Scott, normally when a president is on the way out, they don't fire a lot of people. That's a very strange way to concede defeat. Do you take this as Steve says, just an expression of vengeance and spite against individuals, or is there something else going on here?
I do think that's probably the best way to read it. I mean, you can see people moving around towards the end of an administration for a number of reasons. One, I guess we should acknowledge, is that if the Trump administration actually thought it was going to continue into another term, it may start go ahead and moving personnel around to set itself up for the next 4 years. That would not be unusual. It should not have any such realistic expectations at this point, despite rhetoric to the contrary. I don't think people are quite as self-delusional internally there as the external rhetoric may imply. So I don't think that's the most likely motivation, but it's at least possible, something we should acknowledge. Sometimes you see people moving around in an effort to give people opportunities to spend time in certain positions because it increases post-governmental opportunities. It boosts resumes, things like that. Or I should say, sometimes you just want continuity. You don't want people leaving and kind of uprighting the boat. There actually may have been some part of that behind Bonnie Glick removal. What they essentially appeared to have done in this case is that her supervisor, the acting administrator, had reached the statutory end of the period in which he could serve in that capacity as an acting role. So they're bumping down and making him acting deputy and then removing her to facilitate that so that he can essentially remain in control. It's not a great justification, not 100% clear why that's necessary, mostly because of their over-reliance upon these acting positions, but at least there's an idea of preserving some continuity here. But most of these cases do, and particularly the Esper case, do appear to be primarily personally motivated. We knew Esper had prepared a letter of resignation, notably last week, at least that was reported publicly, not an unusual thing to do in the advance of a transition one way or the other between administrations. But it's not 100% clear. It certainly doesn't look like Esper was even provided the opportunity to provide that letter of resignation. The president said essentially he is terminated. And the media reporting now is that Chief of Staff Meadows called Esper and told him he was fired without requesting the letter of resignation, at least in the reporting that I've seen so far. That may change. So that's got a personal element to it. The other factor that says that this is really personal is it's just a tremendously bad idea from the perspective of governance. These people are only going to be in office two and a half more months until before January 20th. And during that time, it's a lot of work to get up to speed and start transitioning information over to the new administration. And that's especially true in national security, a place where I think most people accept a relatively what might be small oversights in other contexts can have very outsized ramifications and consequences for the American people. So doing this really is, there's a risky element to it, both in terms of actual risk to the United States, its national security interests, and also politically to Trump, because it just looks like a bad move. I don't think most people are going to look at this very positively, certainly from the perspective of his historical legacy. And I should say, I don't know what policy interest they have that Esper might be blocking now. There were these discussions that Esper over the summer prevented Trump from deploying active duty military or mobilizing the National Guard to try and, you know, put an end to different unrest around different parts of the country like you wanted to. You know, some people were discussing that being a possibility in the context of the election, but that window for that really has closed at this point. The ballots have been counted. The information's out there. There's not clear really what the military is going to do aside from start trying to impose some version of martial law. And it's hard to imagine anyone really getting behind that, no matter who's in charge of the Defense Department. So, you know, barring some sort of policy interest that just isn't apparent to us right now, a personal motivation, that kind of grudge, which we've seen President Trump pursue in multiple instances in the past, very similarly through these aggressive by way of dismissive tweets, firing and removing people, that's just the best explanation I can come up with.
Susan, one thing that a president doesn't typically do the week before the election is to remove the deputy administrator of USAID. I mean, you know, it's like that's got to be low on the president's priority list. The list of people who seem to have been targeted here, with the exception of Secretary Esper, seem to have relatively little in common. As best as I can see, there isn't like a unifying thread here. Do you have any sense of like what collectively about these people causes the president to care about them in the days immediately before and immediately after the election?
Yeah, so I think we have to acknowledge that we're speculating at this point. That said, I do think it's fair to assume, at least until some plausible alternative is demonstrated, that the unifying feature of these individuals are either that they've done something to come to the personal attention and animus of the president. I think that's likely the case in the case of Mark Esper, or they're individuals who are in some way creating an impediment to something that the president or Trump administration officials want to achieve before January 20th. You can imagine regulatory implementation, contracts, all kinds of things that might be swirling that people are trying to get done before January 20th and the beginning of a new administration. And so it's plausible that there's a motivation for all of this and for every one of them, and they're sort of their specific and individual. And of course, there's the possibility that this really is just kind of about settling scores and holding, you know, various sort of personal grudges of individuals who happen to have the president's year. I'm inclined to sort of agree, you know, both with Scott and Steve in not really thinking that, for example, Secretary of Defense Esper's firing is an indication of some, right, that he refused to carry out some very alarming unlawful order. You know, it seems more like just kind of the pettiness and smallness that we've seen really sort of being part of the entire Trump presidency. And I think the question now is who else? So there's lots of people that could fall in this category of either being people that the president doesn't like and wouldn't mind taking a swipe at on his way out the door, or might plausibly be preventing something from happening between now and January 20th that the Trump administration would like to sort of bake in or authorize or sign off on before leaving. Gina Haspel's name has been mentioned. The only person who's, I think, especially consequential beyond January 20th, of course, is FBI Director Christopher Wray. So this is sort of the one name among the list that's not like the others, because the FBI director is not a purely political appointee. He serves a 10-year term. Wray's term extends, would extend through, if Biden was a two-term president, through the entirety of Biden's presidency. And so I think that's one place to look if we're not just in the world of sort of, you know, who has hurt the president's feelings, and instead, what are the firings in sort of the national security area that might have sort of a long-term consequence of ramifications. Certainly the FBI director is a big one. Beyond that, you know, I think the point that Scott made about sort of the sensitivity and danger of the transition moment in national security. This is a period in which we do tend to see adversaries trying to take advantage, sort of aggressively testing the limits, understanding it's a period of chaos in the United States. Remember, the Department of Defense and all these various agencies are already operating under COVID conditions. It's incredibly difficult. Lots of logistical challenges, people working remotely, right? Trying to sort of just keep the ordinary day-to-day work going is difficult enough. Add on top of that sort of the difficulty and challenges of a transition in any period of time. And also keep in mind, it's not just the abrupt sort of personnel shifts that create consequences at places like DOD, where Esper gets unceremoniously removed. It's also now at NCTC, who's had their principal, you know, suddenly moved into a new role, and they're going to have to scramble as well. You know, that is going to have consequences, not just in mucking up sort of the smoothness of the Biden transition, but, you know, for the immediate security posture and sort of safety of the United States as we navigate this next, you know, pretty perilous 3-month period.
Just one more thing to think about here, and one possibility that occurs to me that is worth thinking about, at least, particularly for these lower level actually removals, and particularly if we see more of them, which is that both Gordon Hegarty at the National Nuclear Security Administration and Bonnie Glick at the USAID, their record, the thing that appears to have motivated their firing, were high profile in the circles of people who follow these things, conflicts with both their direct agency heads, who in turn were channeling a little bit of a Trump administration priority that was seen as bucking maybe the what some would call the more establishment view or more conventional views about what was in the U.S. interest. For Gordon Hegarty, it was a kind of a defunding or limitation of funding and scoping for her agency that led to a big debate over how it will be structured and how it's going to be assigned to different responsibilities between the Defense Department and the Energy Department, where she was at loggerheads with her own technical boss, I believe, in the Energy Department. Bonnie Glick goes over a whole variety of USAID programs and initiatives that the Trump administration has taken some idiosyncratic views towards and uses of. And, you know, maybe this could just be a sign of the Trump administration either A, trying to clear house of people who they're worried would obstruct certain things they may want to get done in the next 80 days. That's maybe not necessarily benign, but maybe a more conventional explanation. Or B, and it could be a combination of the two, a signal to other people in the administration to say, don't be similarly problematic in these next 80 days we have left as we try to get stuff done, or else your head will also be on the chopping block. The latter is not that much of a threat. Plenty of people leave an administration at this stage anyway to transition to their next jobs. But, you know, it might, at this point, it might just be all that the Trump administration really has left to it in terms of trying to rein in and exercise control over even its own ranks.
I'll just add really quickly, I mean, I do think it's worth not glossing over that there's a non-frivolous argument that Miller can't succeed Esper as Secretary of Defense, and that, you know, without going 22 rounds on the interaction between the DoD succession statute and the Federal Vacancies Reform Act, you know, there's at least a non-frivolous argument that the Deputy Secretary of Defense, David Norquist, who is Senate confirmed, actually automatically becomes the acting secretary. So on top of everything everyone has already said, there's just the added specter of at least some degree of uncertainty as to whether, you know, installing Miller as the acting secretary is even lawful. That may not provoke litigation, because SecDef is not a job that usually provokes a ton of litigation, but it's just, you know, it seems like the last thing that you would want at this point is, you know, some kind of uncertain chain of command problem over at the Pentagon.
I knew we weren't going to get through this conversation without a mention of the FVRA. Let's transition to the transition. Steve, I expect this will be a most unusual transition. But let's start by imagining how a transition is supposed to work. And so I want to start with the question of how much of it is law and what does the law require?
So I think, you know, more of it is law, Ben, than I think a lot of folks often realize. And indeed, more of it is law sort of every year, that there have been, you know, increasing efforts to formalize the transition process, to give legal status to a presidential transition team. Frankly, some of which actually raise some interesting constitutional questions, but that's, I think, for another time. The most important part is that this all starts with a statute called the Presidential Transition Act of 1963. And the central idea behind that statute is that this is supposed to be principally logistical, that GSA, the General Services Administration, you know, the government landlord, is basically in charge of facilitating transitions, because it's not meant to be political. It's meant to be just sort of, you know, helping the transition team find space, giving them government email addresses, unlocking pools of money, expediting the security clearance process. And, you know, the tricky part here is that Section 3C of the Presidential Transition Act 1963 says the terms president-elect and vice-president-elect, which are the triggers for all of these authorities, shall mean, quote, such persons as are the apparent successful candidates for the office of president and vice president, respectively, as ascertained by the administrator following the general elections held to determine the electors of president and vice president in accordance with 3 U.S.C. sections 1 and 2. In other words, it actually gives all of this important funding authority and all of this important, you know, symbolic ability to let the transition get going to a Trump-appointed administrator of the GSA, Emily Murphy, who has to make the ascertainment that the statute contemplates, where the only thing she's supposed to ascertain is that someone is apparently successful.
I think this is sort of the provision that we're going to spend the next week or so completely hung up on. And I think it's worth noting, right, this moment of when the GSA administrator has to make this ascertainment. And I think it's worth noting that this was a totally foreseeable moment. And this was a matter of a lot of debate and concern following the 2000 election, in which there was a sort of a genuine and good faith question as to at what point it was clear who the apparent winner of the 2000 election was. In that case, we had a GSA head who was really trying in good faith and was saying, look, I don't want to be the person who accidentally releases millions of dollars of funds to the wrong person. And so it's unclear. And there were there was congressional hearings at the time in which people identified specifically the risk of creating this sort of murky conditions in which candidates could, through frivolous frivolous lawsuits attempt to sort of delay the transition using these legal challenges. So it was really discussed a lot 20 years ago, the need to create some kind of clarity, not just that this was a purely ministerial function, but also what the precise thresholds were, because this moment in which the rest of the world understands that there is, in fact, an apparent winner, and the president and the sitting president just refuses to concede, and his political sort of allies are willing to abet him in that, it's a foreseeable risk, and it really is a dangerous one. Whenever we think, presidential transitions, the most precious commodity is time. Every single day really, really matters. People literally wake up, at dawn, the day after the election, to get to work because there's so much work to be done. And so the idea that in this really, really fraught period, global pandemic, sort of this really dangerous moment, the Trump administration is just kind of petulantly running the clock and using the legal ambiguity, of the statutory language essentially against the American people. I do hope this is a moment in which Congress decides to clarify what precisely this threshold is in the event that we do have elections like this in the future.
Can I cause trouble for a second? I mean, I agree with everything Susan said, and it's worth stressing that even the 9/11 Commission report pointed to the uncertainty over the Bush transition as hindering U.S. intelligence development for a period of time in the late 2000s. I guess, in one sense, the statute seems to be completely on Susan's and President-elect Biden's side because it refers not to the later events of the certification of electors by states, the deadline for which is December 8th under 3 U.S.C. 5 and 7, or the meeting of the Electoral College, right, on December 14th. It refers to the general election, which is, the thing that happened last Tuesday. But I guess the problem is, on the flip side, what would be a more specific statutory definition? I mean, no state has certified its results yet, I think, except maybe Delaware, certainly not states that total 270 electoral votes. I guess, Susan, I hear you, and I think we are past the point where it is apparent within the meaning of both the statutory terms and the historical practice. I'm just not sure what Congress could do other than perhaps give that determination to someone who isn't a presidential appointee, right? To create a different statutory trigger than where we are today.
Well, I also think what they could do is shift the risk, right? And say you can release the funds as soon as there is a good faith basis to believe that there is an apparent winner. And either we accidentally might spend a couple million dollars or funds will be made on a reimbursable basis, right? That was sort of the suggestion in the Bush v. Gore period that it's so important, you should let both of them get to work. But certainly, vesting this authority with a career official, I think, is a relatively obvious place to start. That said, I don't disagree that, this is a difficult position for the head of GSA to be in, because ordinarily you have a candidate who has conceded. And whenever you do have ongoing litigation, you have a president that hasn't conceded. Knowing exactly what to do in this moment is not an easy call. That said, it's getting less and less hard with every minute, and it's harder and harder to believe that the delay here is actually about some sort of question of good faith uncertainty instead of just being like a stall tactic.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. But what I will say is this: is that the historical case we have, at least the closest one that I could parallel, is 2000, where essentially they did wait for the actual concession to come out. In that case, it happened to align with the day on which the electors cast their vote, which was a date we've seen cast around as saying, "Oh, that's a reasonable date to hang out here." For the reason Steve noted, it's really not necessarily reasonable to wait later in the process. Just because the electors cast their votes, that actually doesn't decide who the actual president-elect is in a constitutional sense. That actually doesn't happen until January 6th or an alternate date that Congress may choose, but usually around January 6th, when they actually count the electoral votes. That's the point where you actually determine, okay, this person's going to become president on January 20th. You obviously can't wait for that. And the statute's very clear that you're not supposed to wait for that. For the reason Steve's note that it refers back to these earlier electoral dates. But, I'm not sure it's necessarily entirely unreasonable for a GSA to wait at least for a certain period after a concession. Remember, we had Saturday, it was the first instance we've had of the media calling the election, and now we're 2 days later. There are still the outstanding, almost entirely frivolous legal claims, but we haven't seen the concession yet. And I'm not sure it's inappropriate for GSA to wait some period for there to be a mutually agreeable resolution to this. And in part, that's because a lot of the statutory reforms we've seen more recently around this have actually shifted some of these steps to actually pre-election transition. Like there's been a conscious effort to set up, including as part of the statutory regime, opportunities by which presidential candidates before the election, even from the major parties at least, can start planning for the transition, get some access to GSA resources. There's an existing MOU between GSA and the Biden administration where they can start doing this. The big costs, as far as I can tell, particularly in the national security front, are A, right now they can only really get expedited clearances for the transition officials. If once they become president-elect, then they can actually get expedited security clearances for the prospective cabinet nominees and other senior nominees, I think down to the undersecretary level. Some language to that effect, as I recall in the statute. And B, there's supposed to be, as part of this information handed from the executive branch over to the president-elect that doesn't happen to the candidates, a big kind of download of all the major national security information operations of classified information handed over to them. And that's supposed to happen and hasn't happened yet, presumably. And both of those things is worth noting. The statute explicitly says these are supposed to happen as soon as possible after the election to ensure there is maximum coverage and least chances of getting dropped. So there's this real tension here. But, you know, a lot of the most immediate costs of holding off on the formal determination haven't quite accrued yet, but they will quickly. Right now, Biden people still are able to actually even spend money on the basis of it being reimbursed. In OLC in 2000, 2001, basically said, look, if later we determine somebody but is in fact the president-elect and they've spent money before they've reached that, they can actually be reimbursed for it. So as long as the Biden administration has cash on hand, which they do, they can begin to start doing this. And actually, there's been an effort to get campaigns to establish a separate fund specifically for this purpose, which I believe the Biden campaign has. They still have transition officials in. They can begin that process. And so, you know, again, I don't think it's totally unreasonable to maybe have a period of a couple days to say, all right, let's see if President Trump comes around, et cetera, et cetera. But if we start getting to the point of people are actually thinking about pushing to something as absurd as December 14th or really absurd like January 6th, that's the point where you really are pushing against the actual logic of the statute and a place where hopefully the congressional sponsor of this legislation, many of whom are still in Congress, includes Republicans and Democrats, would weigh in and say, this isn't what we intended. I'm not terribly optimistic, but an ideal universe, that's what we would hope to see happen.
But Scott, just a minor point on this point about sort of the funding. I actually think that's one of the most powerful arguments for why we actually do need some form of statutory reform. Because you're right, exactly what has occurred here is that we now have additional private fundraising going on to support what the Biden team anticipated would be this far more difficult transition period in which they might not have access to the funds. One of the purposes of the Presidential Transition Act and of providing these funds in the first place, although not the only purpose, was to not have a privately funded transition. This is the moment in which we're moving away from a campaign that is funded by private donors and moving into the work of government, the work of government that is paid for by taxpayer dollars and not by private dollars, because we want these people to be making decisions, ultimately governance decisions, on the basis of, in the interests of, and in a way that is accountable and transparent to the American public. And so I a little bit fear that if we move if this becomes sort of setting the expectations of, well, now campaigns will just start sort of fundraising separately, for these privately funded transitions. I do think we should sort of, you know, flag that that has some really, really bad policy consequences if it were to become sort of an entrenched long-term expectation.
All right. So just to clarify, Steve, has the GSA administrator given any sense of what the trigger for her will be?
No. I mean, I think the only thing we've seen is there was a public statement put out by GSA, not under Administrator Murphy's name, that the administrator has not yet made her ascertainment, but will do so when the law requires, which is, of course, a perfectly equivocal statement. And of course, that then raises the question, well, suppose she doesn't. I mean, even if you think that there's still a little bit of time to let things, you know, work out, that, you know, maybe the frivolousness of the remaining challenges to these lawsuits will become yet more readily apparent in the coming days, although I gather, you know, McConnell's on the Senate floor right now saying, you know, these lawsuits should be allowed to run their course. The question is, does there come a point at which her refusal to make the ascertainment becomes justiciable in the sense that, you know, the president-elect could actually take her to court and seek a writ of mandamus compelling her to do it. And I have to say, I'm skeptical. I mean, the way the statute's written, it seems to confer a heck of a lot of discretion upon the administrator, certainly at least until states have certified their results. Maybe there's a stronger argument for some kind of judicial relief on the far side of state certifications if she still refuses to certify. But, you know, I think the reality is that, like, there's going to come a point where the levee breaks. And even if the president doesn't concede, where, you know, sort of signs coming out of the administration are that they acknowledge it's over. And I suspect that that's going to be, you know, sooner rather than later, maybe not today or tomorrow, but, you know, before Thanksgiving as opposed to after. And so I guess the question is just, like, how much of a hindrance is it to the transition if this certification comes, you know, next Wednesday as opposed to tomorrow? You know, I think it's a real logistical headache. Whether it actually redounds to the detriment of our security is something we're only going to be able to find out in retrospect.
All right. So let's assume that over the next few days, as it becomes clear that these litigations have no merit and are going nowhere, the administrator does the ascertainment. And what happens next under the statute? What's the next phase of activity that the law actually has something to say about?
So, I mean, just a couple of quick points. I mean, the first is it unlocks a whole bunch of money for the transition team to spend on setting up shop. It opens the door to, for example, government email addresses. It opens the door to so-called landing teams that will go into all of the major agencies and start working with their, you know, soon-to-be predecessors. It opens the door to start processing security clearances for folks who are being brought on to work in security clearance-related jobs. I mean, it really sort of clears a lot of traps, Ben, in ways that would allow the administration to hit the ground running, you know, on January 20th versus spending the first 2-3 weeks doing paperwork.
So there's been a fair bit of talk about whether the Trump administration will cooperate with the transition or not. How much latitude, you know, you can give people a lot of government email addresses and give them money and let them in the agency, but basically give them no information. Not let them tail people, not let them figure out what the active subjects are. How much of an actual transition is a function of discretionary judgments by the agencies and by the administrations to give the incoming administration a whole lot of access to material?
I mean, I think the answer, Ben, of course, is a whole lot. I mean, and this is the key, right, which is that Administrator Murphy, at the end of the day, has a formal determination to make that unlocks access to money and logistical resources, but that really pales in comparison to how much the transition really turns upon informal relationships and informal cooperation between, you know, outgoing political agency heads and incoming landing teams for each of these departments. And, you know, the model historically, even in the Obama to Trump transition, right, has been a pretty, if not friendly, at least cordial and cooperative process where, you know, you hear scattershot reports of people behaving badly, but the norm is cooperation. We don't have a lot of precedent, Ben, for, you know, a transition where there's actually a non-cooperation directive or even sort of norm. And I think we don't know just how badly that could go, but obviously it could make life very, very difficult for, you know, folks trying to get up to speed on these positions and, you know, frankly, in the national security space on the threat matrix we're facing.
I mean, look, I do think we have to sort of understand the context of a massive, sprawling federal bureaucracy. So let's imagine sort of hypothetically there is this non-cooperation directive and it's being sort of carried out by the heads of these various agencies. They can sort of do that to prevent information from coming to transition, landing teams, on a few sort of high-profile issues that are likely to sort of be apparent very, very quickly after January 20th. But at the end of the day, there's just so much sort of papers to move and meetings to be had that, you know, 98% of this is performed by career civil servants who are meeting the people that are almost certainly going to be their bosses in just a few months' time. This is one of sort of the benefits of having a career civil service. Their incentives are to, sort of respect the continuity and ultimately to do what's best for their own agency. And so the idea that even if we had sort of this overt obstructionist effort, setting aside sort of the political optics of that and how it might actually play out, I think on the ground, you know, the people who actually are carrying this out in the day-to-day, their incentives are to engage in good faith, get the people the information that they need to be cooperative and helpful, because everybody sees the writing on the wall, and ultimately federal agency employees tend to be most interested in the interests and concerns of their own federal agency and not sort of being part of the president's revenge plot by cutting off their own nose to spite their face.
Scott?
Yeah, I don't disagree with that, but I do think maybe we shouldn't be too rosy about how easy it is for career civil servants to engage in a truly effective transition activities if they are certainly being opposed by their political superiors, even in a lame duck administration, and even if they're not getting at least some tacit support or permission from those officials. You know, it's been a difficult 4 years for a lot of people in the civil service, I think, particularly national security agencies, but really throughout the government. And I think we've kind of seen the fact that a lot of these talk about the deep state is not true in terms of a lot of civil servants are there. And even if they don't like a policy, you are going to see them generally most of the time feel obligated, as they probably should, to follow the lead of their political directors in a manner that's consistent with the law. And, you know, this is, I don't think, a case where we're going to see maybe as many people saying, well, if I'm directly told by my secretary not to play along with this because we're contesting the election results or something else, that they're going to buck that. Now, maybe they will behind the table. I mean, everybody has friends. Again, as we said before on this podcast, this is a unique team coming on the Biden side because they were just in government, many of them just 4 years ago. They know a lot of these people. A lot of them are friends. A lot of them are former colleagues. So there will be some connection and information happening, probably much more on the informal level than has happened in previous transitions. But at the official level, you know, there's a lot that can get in the way. And I wonder whether that might counsel for, at least in, you know, a reasonable period before the costs get too high of further delay on the Trump side, if that's not an argument to try and downplay some of these more formal obstructions and hope to get them resolved relatively quietly. The one thing we've seen consistently throughout this administration is that when the president gets involved, he gets very dug in and often very counterproductive ways. And this may just be an issue set where it's better to try and keep everything below a political or a public optics level to the point that Trump would register and feel like he is driven to actually get involved and start issuing commands. Instead, just kind of keep it all as quiet as possible and then let mid-level people, let career people do their jobs without any sort of direction from higher up. And I wouldn't be terribly surprised if at least in the near term for the next week or two, that's what we see the Biden team pursuing that approach. If things don't change in another week or two, particularly around this formal designation, they don't get access to more resources, then it starts really becoming a problem. And then maybe they'll take a little harder line. But until then, I think we're likely to see an effort to kind of quietly work this out and begin some transition efforts without making it, while trying to find ways without making it too political or public an issue or confrontation with the Trump folks.
So one of the major things that a transition has to do is staff a new administration. The last time I looked, there were something like 4,000 political appointments in the broader executive branch. Not all of those are appointments that need to be made right away, but there are several hundred that need to be made almost right away. And there are quite a lot that need to be made in a reasonable period of time. In the Trump administration, staffing these positions was difficult for one reason, which was that the A team of Republican potential appointees was really not available, and the Trump transition was not willing to consider people who had been on certain anti-Trump letters anyway. So there was a real loyalty test. For the Biden folks, there's a different set of challenges and opportunities. So Susan, give us a sense of what the staffing priorities are, and also what we know about how they're thinking about it. You know, it's a big administration you've got to fill.
Yeah. So the first thing I'd sort of caution to all listeners is this is a period of, you know, there are so many trial balloons being launched from so many different directions, you know, to try and ignore to as much to the extent possible, sort of the specific names that are being bandied about for various jobs. You know, there's lots of interested sort of actors here. And so, you know, sort of treat all of that reporting with a grain of salt until the transition itself indicates what it's doing. One thing I think that'll be really interesting to see how it plays out, particularly in the national security space, is Joe Biden has been very open about his intention to increase diversity, not just at the cabinet level, but at sort of across the senior level levels of government, both racial and ethnic diversity and also gender diversity. And so, you know, he's clearly thinking about bringing in a new and more representative sort of crop of talent. And in some, you know, and certainly there are plenty of people who sort of fit those descriptions who are qualified for these roles. But there is an area in which sort of that might be a little bit in tension with one of his other, you know, sort of real challenges at the moment. And that's that ultimately this is a restoration project and sort of an immediate rescue project. And so that means that Biden is going to want to see agency officials who are ready to govern on day one. There's going to be sort of no margin for a real learning curve here. You know, and we saw that it took the Obama administration, you know, a couple of months to find its footing, as it does for each new administration. And so I think there are really, really strong incentives for Biden to pick known commodities, not just known commodities to the public, but known commodities in the buildings in which they're going to lead, right? So somebody who has stature within the Department of Justice, right, who can sort of draw on legacy knowledge and respect, you know, in the Pentagon, in every one of the intelligence agencies, people who are known to those agencies, likely because they previously served in leadership positions. That group is disproportionately white and male. And so I do think that while there are, you know, some sort of obvious people who are both well-known commodities with a lot of credibility within the building, you know, people like Susan Rice, Sally Yates, I mean, the list goes on and on and on of who people might be. You know, whenever we start to think sort of down to the, you know, sort of one level down, the people who are a little bit less visible to the public, but hold really, really key roles within the agencies themselves, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that pressure plays out and whether or not there it actually is a tension at the end of the day. You know, the reality might be that they can put, you know, diverse candidates in every single position in the U.S. federal government and have lots of names to spare. There are long lists of qualified candidates. You know, but I do think there's sort of an alternative possibility, especially whenever you look at really, really sort of critical key roles in places that have just been through the ringer and for which it is not entirely clear how they are going to find their way back. So I think that's something just sort of as the new administration starts to take shape, just will be something I'm interested in seeing how exactly it plays out.
Scott, what are the other, from your point of view, what are the other key challenges of staffing, not just a new administration, but this new administration in the national security space?
I think Susan, you know, checked a lot of the boxes. The honest to goodness truth is that this administration is in a really good position for the reason that we noted before, which is that it is stocked with people who left government relatively recently and were there for 8 years, were many of them, maybe not for the entirety of 8 years, but for an extended period, really working on a lot of these issues. They have really long Rolodexes of people with a lot of experience. And so I think actually, if anything, I think Susan kind of hits the nail on the head. Some of the challenges is going going to be bringing in new blood. Certainly, there's a diversity challenge there along a variety of lines. You know, there is also this increasing political divide in the Democratic Party about, well, how do you approach the fact that there's a progressive wing, particularly around foreign affairs issues? And that's kind of, Ascendant is saying, it's putting it too strongly, but is kind of on the rise, or certainly has in a stronger position than it has been for many years in the party. A lot of it based upon strong organizing against the war in Yemen, around a variety of other kind of foreign policy issues. We've seen a dramatic shift to the left, certainly around issues around Israel-Palestine issues, a number of other issues within the party that has kind of undermined some support for some of the more conventional foreign policy views and foreign policy figures. We're seeing this very competitive race for the HVAC chair, potentially, where we have a consciously progressive, explicitly progressive, I believe, kind of candidate in Congressman Castro. So, you know, there is this kind of new debate going on about how do we reconcile these progressive views with more conventional views. And that's going to be a really tricky one for the Biden administration. Remember, the Obama administration really focused a lot on transparency around war powers issues, around a lot of explaining its legal views around national security issues, but there had a lot of continuity in relatively broad views, certainly about things like the use of force, with the late Bush administration. And that has continued through the Trump administration. And some people have started, we want to see an end to this. And we've seen it in Biden's platform where he says, we're going to bring an end to endless wars. That's a catch line that doesn't necessarily signal a lot of clear content about what exactly that means in practice, but it does indicate at least a recognition that this issue is important. And so, you know, it means how do you bring in people that are going to talk about, you know, reforming AUMFs or repealing and replacing AUMFs, fixing the war powers resolution, things like that. And then where does that even fit on a legislative agenda? My guess is not super high. Maybe we'll see a lot of people who want to say, well, let's focus on transparency. That's something the executive branch can do off the bat. But there are these new progressive voices that may not find that enough and that are going to want to be represented in the incoming administration. And so that's another sort of factor that goes into staffing this. And that's one where they can't just rely too heavily on the people who were in government the last time around.
Yeah, I think that's really right. But it also raises a different tension, which is any effort that you make to satisfy the progressive forces with appointments is potentially going to run into some trouble on the Senate confirmation side. Steve, what are your thoughts on whether it is actually possible to thread that needle? That is, you have the progressive foreign policy community that really wants a significant change in the way we do in the theory of American foreign policy. And then you have a likelihood, I don't know how high a likelihood, that the Senate will be still run by Mitch McConnell, barring, you know, two very surprising results in Georgia. Is this a needle that the new administration is going to have a difficult time threading with its appointments?
I mean, I think the short answer is yes, although perhaps that actually buys the new administration some cover. I mean, I think the million-dollar question is, assuming that the Republicans win at least one of the Georgia runoffs, you know, is McConnell going to be in any way conciliatory and compromising? You know, is he going to actually agree to some nominees, but not all? Because if he's just a categorical obstructionist, you know, that's one thing. But if he's actually willing to accept, you know, what he deems to be moderate nominees over what he deems to be, you know, unmoderate nominees, the irony of that is that it might actually provide the president-elect with cover to name folks who are not as progressive and not as, you know, to the wing of the party as he might have been under pressure to do so, on the ground that those folks might not be confirmable. And so, you know, it's going to be a very interesting dance to see how it unfolds. And mind you, it's going to unfold very, very quickly. I mean, when, you know, when we had the transition in 2016, the new Congress started confirmation hearings for President Trump, for President-elect Trump's, I guess, putative nominees, even before Trump was sworn in. And so we're going to have this remarkable sort of acceleration once the results of the Georgia runoff are clear, where, you know, we're going to find out pretty quickly is, if McConnell's in charge, is he going to be at all compromising? Is he going to receive any pressure from the more moderate forces within his own caucus to be compromising? Does that in turn exert pressure on, you know, the Biden administration to moderate itself with nominees? And if so, is that actually something they might welcome because they can blame McConnell for not picking more aggressively progressive candidates? I mean, I think that's, you know, that's why this is really going to be a lot of chess as opposed to checkers. And, you know, I guess, Ben, I'm not as willing to give up on Georgia as you. I mean, I think if it flips over, all of a sudden, you know, Joe Manchin becomes one of the most important people in this conversation.
Oh, I'm not assuming the Republican candidates will win the runoff. My point is, if you're Joe Biden right now, you have to staff your administration on the assumption that you may very well not be in control of the Senate.
Well, and so I think, you know, for example, Susan Rice becomes a very interesting trial balloon. You know, is Susan Rice confirmable as Secretary of State in a Senate run by Mitch McConnell? Right. You know, I think Michelle Flournoy, I think, is probably less controversial in that respect. And so, you know, I think a lot of this is going to be back channel, where there's going to be efforts, I think, from, you know, the transition team to reach out to McConnell. And I think they're going to try to sort of take his temperature on just what he is and is not willing to go along with. And not for the first time, well, for the first time, but certainly not for the last time. You know, I think it's going to be a really fascinating question for the president-elect and his team, how much to actually try to go along with McConnell and how much to simply say, you know, we're going our way. And if you stand up to us, you know, you're just giving us ammo for 2022. I think that's going to be one of the defining stories, right, about at least those policy areas where he needs at least some buy-in from Congress, especially when it comes to appointments. And, you know, Ben, especially if he's not willing to be quite as aggressive in relying upon, you know, vacancies regimes, for example, as his predecessor has been.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting question to watch. And one question will be whether Biden's long Senate service will cause him to handle Mitch McConnell differently from the way Barack Obama did. There's that great joke that Obama told about McConnell where he said, you know, people say I should have a beer more often with Mitch McConnell. You have a beer with Mitch McConnell. But Joe Biden is actually likely to try to cultivate him. And it'll be really interesting to see whether that bears any fruit in the staffing of the administration or in anything else. We are going to leave it there. Scott Anderson, Steve Vladek, Susan Hennessy, thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the elusive Zachary Frank of the firm of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell. Our promotion department is you, so get on it. Leave us a rating or review wherever you found us. And for heaven's sake, share us on social media of all types. If you're the downloading TikTok type, make a TikTok video about us. Our merch is available at the Lawfare store. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.